This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Marjorie Cohen, the past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a constitutional litigator. We speak about the forthcoming election crisis and what might be the end of capitalist democracy.
Black Lives Matter protests have occurred in the city of Detroit since May 29. For the first 5 days, Detroit police responded to the protests with excessive force. They unleashed tear gas and rubber munitions and freely wielded nightsticks and shields to assault and beat protesters. On August 31st, the Legal Coalition filed a civil lawsuit against the Detroit Police Department to obtain injunctive relief from the use of unlawful violence against protesters. The case is called Detroit Will Breathe at Dahlia v. City of Detroit. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Law and Disorder was saddened at the recent and unexpected death of attorney and activist Kevin Zeese. Kevin passed away on September 5th after suffering a heart attack. Recently, Kevin was a guest on our show in March to discuss activists' occupation of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. They occupied the embassy to prevent it from being handed over to coup leaders sponsored by the Trump administration. As most listeners likely know, since 1980, Kevin dedicated his life to drug policy reform. He was instrumental in helping turn the tide of public opinion about ill-informed laws and harsh penalties. Over the past 2 decades, Kevin also dedicated his talents to anti-war efforts, the mass incarceration crisis, and several campaigns for economic justice, including Occupy Wall Street. Kevin was active in third-party and independent electoral campaigns. For example, in 2004, he served as press secretary for Ralph Nader's presidential run. Michael and I send heartfelt condolences to Kevin's family and loved ones. Last month, Kevin spoke at the United National Anti-War Conference on how we can bring about social change. It goes to the core of what he stood for. Let's take a listen.
Power to the people. We have the power to make the change if we stay united. We have incredible opportunity now. We see the movements growing, and we see now for all clear to see, especially after the DNC and RNC, the convention showed us that those parties do not represent the people, that our power is not in elections. Our power is building people power, and we see that happening. We need to build power so that in 2021, people can rule from below, so we can call general strikes, so we can stop business as usual. We need to be able to make our country ungovernable so our demands are heard and met. That is the only way change will occur. It will not come from Joe Biden or Donald Trump. It will come from the people. We have to understand, this is often very hard for people to understand, but the only path to success is failure. We fail and fail and fail until we win. But every time we try, we build the movement and we get stronger. We can never tell how close we are to success. It's like we're banging on a wall, pounding and pounding. And it's not till that wall begins to crack that we start to see the light come through and we realize we're getting close to that breakthrough moment when change can occur. We see the 2020s as a decade of transformation. The movements have been growing since Occupy in 2011, and then the Black Lives Matter movement, the Fight for 15, all during the Obama era and the growing of the movements in the Trump era. We see the 2020s as a decade of social transformation. In order to have that transformation succeed, we need to be organized and educated. In the chat box, you see a link to our Movement School, How Social Transformation Occurs. That's popularresistance.org/school. It's a free school where you can learn how movements grow, how they develop, the various stages of movements, and how it's normal for us to not always be on a linear path to success, but it's a jagged path. And we move up and we get stronger. We all know that Donald Trump is terrible. Worst president of my life. His overt racism, his open support for violent white supremacists, his mishandling of the COVID-19 virus, causing more than 180,000 deaths so far, probably more than 200,000 by the time we get to the election. His poor response to the economic collapse is leading us into another Great Depression. And he consistently puts in place laws for the wealthy while poverty, homelessness, debt, and joblessness increase. But Biden is no better. And I mean no better. For 47 years, he's been wrong on every important issue. My career began when I was in college, going to an anti-racism demonstration in Boston in favor of school integration. At that time, Biden opposed school integration. Then I worked on ending mass incarceration, ending the drug war, while Biden was passing laws to escalate the drug war, passing laws of mandatory sentencing to increase mass incarceration. He's the architect of mass incarceration. Then later in his career, when he became chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he led the effort, not just voting for the Iraq war, but leading the effort to make the Iraq war happen and every other war. As chair of foreign relations, he put in place massive military budgets, bloated, corrupt budgets, while leading us into war after war. And then when it came to student bankruptcy, he led the effort to make it so students can't get rid of school debt, even in bankruptcy. And now he's even calling for cutting Social Security when we should be doubling or even tripling Social Security payments. So I'm going to vote against Trump by voting for what I believe in. There are more alternatives than the two parties. I'll be voting Green candidates Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker because I'm going to be voting for Medicare for All. I'm going to be voting for community control of police, for the eco-socialist Green New Deal, for ending the wealth divide and ending the never-ending wars. We all have the power to vote for what we believe in. Candidates reflect the movement. There are many more choices than the two corrupt candidates of the millionaires. And we need to use the elections, the little power we have in the elections, to send a message for what we are for, to show that those who speak for movement issues get the movement's support. After we vote, we must build people power so that people can rule from below. We must build people power so that no matter who's in office, we can stop the government from operating. We can make the country ungovernable. We can put in place general strikes so that our demands are heard and met. That is how we will win. We have a lot to build on, from the Occupy movement in 2011 through the Black Lives Matter and Fight for 15 and the current uprisings today. There have been over 900 wildcat strikes since March. The labor movement is going. The climate justice movement is going. The anti-racist movement is going. The anti-inequality movement is going. We have a lot to build on. The 1% cannot defeat the 99% if we are organized. So don't underestimate ourselves. We can stop this issue. We can make the change we want. Power to the people. Thank you all for being here.
That was Kevin Zee speaking last month at the United National Anti-War Conference.
What if Trump is voted out of office on November 3rd, but on January 20, when he is scheduled to vacate the White House, he refuses to go? His lawyer and fixer, Michael Cohen, predicted this in his congressional testimony before he went off to prison. Trump is already casting doubt on the legitimacy of the election, which is less than 2 months away. He says there will be massive voter fraud, that absentee balloting, which will be widely prevalent because of the COVID crisis, is easily open to fraud. Can Trump send federal troops to Washington, D.C. or other cities? Can he deploy the National Guard of the various states? Can he suspend habeas corpus, arbitrarily detain people, or declare martial law? Can he investigate opponents, freeze their assets, control communications, initiate a foreign crisis, or get help from Attorney General William Barr? And what can we do about this? We speak today with Attorney Marjorie Cohn. She's the past president of the National Lawyers Guild and a professor emerita at the Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego. Marjorie Cohn, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Marjorie, do you think that Michael Cohn was right when he predicted in his congressional testimony that Trump would not peaceably leave office?
Oh, man, I hope he was not right, but a lot of signs point the other way. Trump preemptively sowing doubt about the election, suggested delaying the election, suggested sending federal troops to the polls to police non-existent voter fraud. And Trump declared on the first night of the RNC, Democrats are trying to steal the election. The only way they can take this election away from us is if it's a rigged election. And when Chris Wallace asked him on Fox News Sunday in July, are you suggesting that you might not accept the results of the election? Trump replied, no, I have to see. And he's also tinkering with the Postal Service, which is sacrosanct. He admitted that he's blocking emergency funding for the Postal Service and said, well, they don't have the money to do the universal mail-in voting. He's worried that the mail-in votes are going to go for Biden. And his new Postmaster General, who has incredible conflicts of interest, instituted several changes that have slowed down mail service, including the removal of 671 sorting machines, and that since June. So I hope that Michael Cohen is wrong, but I fear that he may be correct.
So what might unfold on January 20th if Trump doesn't vacate? What are the various scenarios?
Well, it's frightening, Michael. Under the Presidential Succession Act, if there is no clear winner by January 20th, and even if Biden is the clear winner, if Trump doesn't vacate, the Speaker of the House becomes president. That's Nancy Pelosi, of course. But would the Supreme Court ratify that if Donald Trump challenged it? You know, the Supreme Court is very precariously balanced, tipped to the right, although John Roberts is concerned about his legacy. He's not just a radical right winger. He also has this legacy to protect and at least the appearance of impartiality. Hopefully there won't be armed fighting in the streets because Donald Trump, you know, his supporters are not just armed. They're armed with assault weapons. So your guess is as good as mine, but hopefully it will not come to that.
So can Trump send federal troops into Washington, D.C. like he did the last time? Or can he send them into other cities?
Well, each state has its own National Guard, and every member of the National Guard is a member of the Army Reserve, and each member of the state National Guard wears two hats, state and federal. Now, generally, members of the state National Guards are under the command of the governor of their state, but once they're called into federal service, they cease acting as agents of the state and they become armed forces of the federal government. Except for the National Guard of Washington, D.C., which is the D.C. National Guard, and in that instance, the president, not the city's mayor, is the commander-in-chief of the D.C. National Guard. Now, the D.C. National Guard has been used regularly. Most members of the state National Guard have been mobilized by the respective governors when they are mobilized. And in Washington, D.C., they are acting under the direction of the president. But I guess the short answer to your question is yes.
Can Trump use the National Guard from one state and send it in to another state without the permission of the governors of either state?
I was actually answering that question just now. In terms of generally sending, and he can, when he's the commander-in-chief of the state National Guard, he can certainly deploy them where he wants. In terms of sending federal troops into Washington, D.C. and other cities, he sent them to Portland, he sent them to Wisconsin. He was about to send them to Chicago when actually it was, I'm proud to say, the National Lawyers Guild and Black Lives Matter Chicago and other plaintiffs, but notably the National Lawyers Guild, who filed a lawsuit to prevent a Portland-style occupation, federal occupation of Chicago. And they were successful, I think, because although Trump did send some agents into Chicago, they were assigned to already existing cases, FBI, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, Drug Enforcement Administration. So there was nothing like what we saw in Portland. But he did not invoke the Insurrection Act, which, you know, if he did, which he might do after the election to get the military out into the streets, then that triggers other powers, I think, which we can talk about.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about the what they call PEADS, P-E-A-D-S, Positive Emergency Action Documents. Do these allow for suspension of habeas corpus or arbitrary detention or the declaration of martial law?
Well, it's interesting, Michael, because these PEDs are Presidential Emergency Action Documents, which originated with President Eisenhower to deal with the possibility of a Soviet attack during the Cold War, and they have purported to authorize unconstitutional actions, including the suspension of habeas corpus, the declaration of martial law, and rounding up people with no legal basis at all. It's arbitrary detention that you mentioned. These PEDs are so secret that not even Congress has seen them, but Freedom of Information Act requests have occasionally led to the revelation of their contents in public sources, and PEDs could presumably provide Trump with an unfettered opportunity to employ authoritarian, even military tactics in order to maintain power.
What about voting with absentee ballots? Are absentee ballots really open to massive fraud, as Trump repeatedly alleges?
No, they're not. It's a red herring. In fact, when his campaign was pressed in a lawsuit to reveal evidence of voter fraud, they couldn't do it. But expect him to raise unsubstantiated claims of voting by undocumented immigrants, foreign governments, Antifa, which means anti-fascist, his boogeymen that he pulls out to solidify his base. Trump he has said that mail-in voting is fraudulent. He tweeted, with universal mail-in voting, not absentee voting, which is good, and of course mail-in voting and absentee voting are the same thing, but Trump tweeted, 2020 will be the most inaccurate and fraudulent election in history. It will be a great embarrassment to the USA. Delay the election until people can properly, securely, and safely vote. And of course, you know, he lobbed that out there. He has no authority to delay the election. But also, he said, he tweeted, must know election results on the night of the election, not days, months, or even years later. He's banking on the absentee ballots not being counted by election night, which they won't be. And there could be up to 40% of people voting by absentee ballot because they don't want to catch COVID by going to the polls. And if it looks like there's a false tally where it looks like Trump is leading on election night because the absentee ballots and the mail-in ballots, absentee ballots, haven't been counted, and he could declare victory. I think that's what he's setting up. Also, the intelligence and election security officials said that mail-in voting is safe from foreign intervention, that we have these things in place. And by the way, after taking office, Trump established a controversial presidential commission to study voter fraud, you know, this red herring. The commission met twice before disbanding, never produced any evidence of widespread voter fraud in U.S. elections.
Would you please, Marjorie Cohn, about the Transition Integrity Project. What is it? What scenarios do they lay out? And what conclusions do they come to?
The Transition Integrity Project, or TIP, is a bipartisan organization of campaign chairs, academics, and former government officials. It was established last year out of concern about the manipulation and disruption of the 2020 presidential election and transition. And in June, TIP conducted election crisis scenario exercises called Preventing a Disrupted Presidential Election and Transition in order to identify risks to the rule of law or the integrity of the democratic process between Election Day and Inauguration Day. TIP assembled a group of more than 100 experts for the experiment, and their report that they issued called the results alarming. They assessed with a high degree of likelihood that November's elections will be marked by a chaotic legal and political landscape, and Trump is likely to contest the result by both legal and extra-legal means in an attempt to hold on to power. They said that they warned about an unprecedented assault on the outcome of the election, and they also disturbingly warned the potential for violent conflict is high, particularly since Trump encourages his supporters to take up arms. Now, TIP developed four scenarios as follows. Number one, the winner was unknown the morning after the election, and the race was too close to call. Number two, Biden won outright the popular vote and the Electoral College. Number three, Trump won the Electoral College by a healthy margin, but lost the popular vote by a healthy margin. And four, Biden won both the popular vote and the Electoral College by narrow margins. So these are the four scenarios that TIP developed, and then they did exercises to flesh out what would happen in each of these scenarios. In all four, Trump cast doubt on the official election results. The second scenario, which is when Biden won outright the popular vote and the Electoral College, initially showed Trump alleging massive fraud, demanding investigations, and appealing to the media to cast doubt on the result. He later accepted a loss once it became clear that his attempts to overturn the election results would not succeed. So that's really the best scenario. In the fourth scenario, which is Biden wins both the popular vote and the electoral vote by narrow margins, Trump would not concede. He set up a fierce competition that ended with an uneasy and combative but ultimately successful transition. So that's kind of the second best best scenario. In all four scenarios, Michael, Trump encouraged violence and chaos in the streets. His strategy called for recounts, investigations into voting, quote, voting irregularities to undermine public confidence in the results of the election, trying to stop the counting of mail ballots, even ordering Bill Barr, his right-hand prostitute who runs the Department of Injustice, even ordering Barr to seize mail ballots. Organizing his base to take to the streets, relying on right-wing media, Fox News, et cetera, to sow chaos and intimidate officials to side with Trump. And where he trailed in the popular vote count, Trump challenged Biden to prove a negative that there had been no voting fraud. The participants in these TIP scenario exercises were particularly concerned about the president's ability to federalize the National Guard, deploy the military domestically, launch investigations into opponents, freeze their assets, and even control communication in the name of national security. Barr could provide legal cover for the president. And the report from TIP cited Trump's prior appeals to Second Amendment people to defend their rights and his calls to supporters to liberate states with restrictive COVID rules. Trump could initiate a foreign crisis after the election or during the transition period. Barr might launch a bogus investigation of so-called terrorist ties of members of Biden's transition team to justify surveillance or a false flag operation before the election or in the contested period after the election.
Trump used to brag, this is about a year ago, that he had the bikers on his side, that he had the cops on his side, and that he had the military on his side. I'm not sure that's true, particularly after the Jeffrey Goldberg piece in The Atlantic to show how Trump ridiculed the military. But what do you think the military might do in this scenario?
It's very hard to say, but Trump might order the military into the streets to quell protests after he tries to hijack the election. And the question is, you know, the military service members under the Uniform Code of Military Justice and Army Field Manual have a duty to obey lawful orders. But that also means they have a duty to disobey unlawful orders. And it may be that military leaders and or service members, this is hopefully, will disobey Trump's illegal orders to go into the streets and, you know, protect his hijacking of the election. Veterans for Peace, and I'm proud to say that I'm on the board of advisors of Veterans for Peace, has urged service members to disobey unlawful orders, reminding them of that. So your guess is as good as mine, but I'm not sure, I'm not confident that the military would obey those unlawful orders.
What about the Republican legislatures in the swing states? What if they refuse to certify a Biden victory?
they might do that. The Republican state legislatures in potentially decisive electoral college states might simply refuse to certify a Biden victory because Trump is crying fraud. That could be Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, or Wisconsin. They might either withhold electoral slates or install their own slates. And so that is a possibility.
What about Trump using the COVID stay-at-home order to prevent protests?
Well, Vanita Gupta, who's the former head of the Justice Department Civil Rights Division, has worried that Trump could weaponize COVID and use it as a pretext to issue stay-at-home orders to prevent people from going to the polls when the deadline for requesting absentee ballots has expired. You know, Michael, he's already declared a national emergency because of COVID, and national emergencies give the president all kinds of scary powers, basically. The National Emergencies Act triggers more than 100 additional powers for the president. He can order the closing of any, under the Communications Act, he can order the closing of any facility or station for wire communication. That could include television, radio, and the internet. He has tremendous powers that he could marshal if he thinks that he might lose, because as I'm sure you know, Michael, there is nothing that Trump hates worse than losing, and he will do anything to maintain power. Legal, illegal, doesn't matter to him.
Can he shut down the internet?
Yes, he can, under the National Communications Act. He can order the closing of any facility or station for wire communication, and there are scholars such as Stephen Rohde, who I think was on your show, said this on Law and Disorder, that this Communications Act could empower him to shut down television, radio, and the internet. He told you that it can give a president a virtual kill switch. Remember that?
I do remember that. What about Facebook and YouTube and Twitter? What role might they play, and what can Trump do to them, and what can they do to Trump?
Well, Facebook is already taking steps to counter false claims of victory on Facebook by Trump supporters. It's planning for what to do if Trump tries to invalidate the election results with accusations that the Postal Service lost mail ballots or other groups meddled with the vote. Facebook has considered a kill switch to stop political advertising from spreading misinformation after Election Day. Twitter and YouTube have also considered actions they might take after the election, although they haven't specified what those would be. And according to Alex Stamos, a former Facebook executive, he told the New York Times, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter have to potentially treat the president as a bad actor. So there you go. I mean, it's nice to see Facebook stepping up to the plate for democracy for a change.
Yeah, except that it's a two-way street. They could also use it against the left. So it's worrisome. We're speaking with attorney Marjorie Cohn, a constitutional lawyer, former law professor, and an expert on this. Marjorie, you wrote a very good article in Truth Out. Can you tell our audience how they could get a hold of that article?
Yes, it's on truthout.org, and actually, if you go to my website, marjoriecohn.com, it has that article and the other articles and books and video things as well, but that at this point is the top article, first article on my website, and it's from Truthout. I link to Truthout, but I have it posted on marjoriecohn.com.
And that's Cohn spelled C-O-H-N. Marjorie, what can be done to safeguard the elections? What can people do now?
Well, there are grassroots state and county coalitions with special focus on North Carolina, Florida, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. They need state coordinators and local activists, poll watchers. There can be lawsuits filed, and there already have been lawsuits filed. Protect Democracy filed a lawsuit to force the Postal Service to disclose its plans for the election. And we can also expect to see additional lawsuits by the National Lawyers Guild and the ACLU, who filed lawsuits to prevent the president from sending his federal forces to Chicago, and also to prevent his federal forces from targeting journalists and legal observers. The National Lawyers Guild is famous for our legal observers who provide witnesses to police brutality, and we also provide legal defense for protesters who are arrested. There will be lawsuits to protect mail ballots in various states, and there have been. In Tennessee, they won. In Kentucky, they won. There have been lawsuits in Wisconsin, South Carolina, to protect voter registration databases, et cetera.
So what are your thoughts about this? Stepping back, you've been a political activist for many decades. You've been a constitutional litigator. What are you thinking about where this country has come to at this point?
Oh, man, it's very, very frightening, Michael. There have been, of course, many bad presidents in the past. There have been notorious war criminals. I wrote extensively about the Bush administration and their illegal wars and war crimes and torture. I also wrote about Obama, who sent drones to kill people illegally in seven different countries and increased illegal surveillance. But Trump really kind of takes this to a new level because there's no pretense of following the law, to say nothing of tradition and culture and all of that. And you never know what he's going to do next, and just when you think that you've seen the worst outrage, then he does something else. Nevertheless, he has this pretty firm support among his so-called base. And the polls are very close. Now, I don't know about the polls. They were not right about, the 2016 election. But I really think that the DNC made a mistake in their convention by not appealing to the youth and to the progressive wing. And I think that it's going to be really a challenge to get young people out to vote. There's so much, negative publicity out there about Democrats. And, of course, there are a lot of problems with the Democratic Party. I think Biden's a terrible candidate, probably the worst candidate. But I am working like crazy to defeat Trump. And that means voting for Biden-Harris. Much as that's distasteful, we've got to get Trump out of there because Trump is making the lives of people in this country and around the world miserable. And when he has no check at all, assuming that he even has a check now because he's already got a second term, if that happens, who knows what he would do. So I think that the real challenge is going to be to get progressives out to vote for Biden and Harris. And there are many people at Roots Action, et cetera, that say, well, if you're in a safe state, you can vote for whoever you want or not vote or write in Bernie. I think that is, that maintains credibility with progressives. But on the other hand, I think that unless Biden wins not just the Electoral College, but the popular vote by an overwhelming margin, and even if he does, Trump is going to cry foul and do everything he can to legally or illegally, and probably illegally, try to maintain power.
Well, on that somber note, Marjorie Cohn, I'm afraid that we've run out of our allotted time, and I'm going to have to say goodbye. But a really heartfelt thank you for your hard work and your ability to articulate the situation so well. Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me, Michael, and keep up your great work as well.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Have occurred in the city of Detroit since May 29. For the first 5 days, Detroit police responded to the protests with excessive force. They unleashed tear gas and rubber munitions and freely wielded nightsticks and shields to assault and beat protesters. In total, they arrested more than 400. The local National Lawyers Guild chapter joined the Detroit Coordinated Legal Defense Coalition to provide legal support. Coalition members are the Detroit chapter of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the Detroit Justice Center, Neighborhood Defender Services, the Wayne County Criminal Defense Bar Association, and Michigan Liberation. Protesters also formed an organization called Detroit Will Breathe, which continues to hold daily protests. On August 31st, the Legal Coalition filed a civil lawsuit against the Detroit Police Department to obtain injunctive relief from the use of unlawful violence against protesters. The case is called Detroit Will Breathe et alia v. City of Detroit. On September 4, the court granted in part the plaintiff's motion for a temporary restraining order. But Police Chief Craig continues a public relations campaign, denying the police department acted unlawfully. Joining us to talk about this victory is Detroit Attorney Julie Hurwitz. Julie is a longtime member of the National Lawyers Guild. Welcome, Julie, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Julie, I just read the complaint and was surprised to see that it contained photographs of multiple incidents of police brutality, really graphic photos also of injuries. How did you obtain these photos?
There is so much video and photographic evidence of what was going on out on the streets of Detroit between the end of May and the end of August that we have been bombarded by journalists and our legal observers and just people on the street who saw these horrific acts take place, and they have been sending them to us, and we have been compiling them, and through those documents, we were able to isolate out several frames and photos that helped to dramatically illustrate what was going on.
Among the allegations in the lawsuit are claims that police tear gassed, pepper sprayed, and beat protesters. Did they also use chokeholds?
They did, indeed. In fact, one of the photographs that is one of the more disturbing photographs that are embedded in our complaint is a picture of one of our plaintiffs, Nakia Wallace, who is one of the leaders of the Detroit Will Breathe organization, being seriously held in a chokehold as she was being arrested on July 10th.
Julie, did police treat black protesters differently than white ones?
From what we have observed, that absolutely seems to be correct. There have been selective uses of force where some of the protesters are beaten more severely than others. There has been verbal abuse toward white protesters who have been in the streets in solidarity with this movement. For example, on one occasion, there was a man who is white who was attempting to assist his wife, who had just been punched in the stomach by a police baton and subsequently suffered a miscarriage, by the way. He was attempting to assist her, and a white officer went right up to him and called him the lowest form of white trash. So there is racial discrimination going on in both directions toward people of color who are out on the streets. There have been witnesses who have observed black activists in the streets being beaten more severely than white. And yet, the spin and the narrative that's being presented by the Detroit Police Department through Chief Craig and his higher-level officials and the mayor is that these are a bunch of outsiders coming in from other parts of the state to disrupt and cause havoc in our city. We don't want you here. You're not welcome. And the black community supports us and opposes you.
Did Detroit police attack legal observers and medics?
Frighteningly so, that is true. In fact, when these protests first started at the beginning of June, May 29th, actually, the very first night that people were in the streets, two of our legal observers were not only beaten but arrested. At that point, we reached out to our Congresswoman, Rashida Tlaib, who is also, by the way, a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and she arranged for a line of communication between me and the deputy chief of the Detroit Police Department, during which time I was able to negotiate an agreement and educate him as to the role that legal observers have played for decades in Detroit, never having been treated the way they were treated here. And he agreed. Once I provided him with the history and a photograph of our beautiful neon green hats and the identity of the two people who were arrested, he agreed and made a commitment to me that he would make sure that every police officer in the department, before going on duty during their prep sessions, before their shift started, he would make sure they all received a copy of the photograph of the hat so they knew what they were looking at, and that they were to leave our legal observers alone. None of them were violating the law. All of them were abiding by whatever orders they could hear, and none of them were anywhere where they were told they weren't allowed to be. And yet, even since then, we have heard stories and have observed several legal observers not only being arrested, but continuing to be assaulted and beaten. I can say without hesitation, I've never seen anything like it. This is the first time, and in fact, I've been legal observing as a member of the Lawyers Guild since 1979, when I lived out in the Bay Area and first started participating as a legal observer during the anti-nuclear protests out there, where thousands of people were arrested at a time. And never have I seen a level of violence and blatant unconstitutional response by law enforcement as I have seen in the streets of Detroit since May 29th. And it is ironic that these protests are predominantly led by Black activists and specifically focusing on the serious problem of police brutality and race and the culture of racism within our law enforcement culture.
Is the composition of the Detroit Police Department mixed, or is it predominantly white?
That's a really interesting question. The Detroit Police Department has undergone some significant transformation since the 60s, during which time Coleman Young, the first Black mayor to be elected in the city of Detroit, on the heels of what has been known as the Detroit Rebellion of 1967, which was a response to a predominantly white police department that was routinely murdering Black citizens in the street on a regular basis, there was a huge shift with the election of Coleman Young, and a much greater percentage of the Detroit Police Department were being hired from the Black community. And there was a time when it was a requirement that to be a Detroit police officer, you had to live in the city of Detroit, which also helped to the recruitment process to bring more Black members of the department in. And over the last 10 years or so, when we had the election of Mayor Mike Duggan, who is a white member of the Democratic machine here in Michigan, they changed the residency requirement so that Detroit police officers no longer have to live in the city of Detroit. And there has been a massive shift back to hiring more white police officers. So it's ironic that Chief Craig and Mayor Duggan are publicly spewing this line that you outsiders aren't welcome in our city, when at this point we believe the majority, I think something a little over 50% of the Detroit Police Department don't even live in the city of Detroit.
The plaintiffs filed a video showing police brutality. Do you think that influenced Judge Mickelson?
I think the judge, in her opinion, took specific notice of what she observed through that video footage. So I can only assume that it did influence her because she was able to see firsthand the contrast between what was being told to her or represented to her by the City of Detroit Law Department and the Police Department and what was actually going on in the streets.
What is the effect of the temporary restraining order?
It depends on who you talk to. According to us, the practical effect is that no longer will the police be permitted to go out into the street and wholesale use violence and mass arrests as their response to what is otherwise peaceful, albeit vocal, but peaceful protests that have become a regular occurrence here in the city of Detroit, as has been going on in cities and towns and villages all over the country. On Friday night, after the issuance of this order, it has also had the effect of bringing way more people out who now are not afraid that they're going to be shot by a rubber bullet or gratuitously assaulted or violently arrested simply by being there. And so there were over 500 people in the streets Friday night celebrating the issuance of this order, knowing that they were safe, they were able to safely exercise their rights under the First Amendment.
Can you describe a few of the worst incidents?
Oh, yes. There had been broken bones. There was a collapsed lung. I think these are not necessarily the named plaintiffs in our case at this time, but there have been a range of injuries that are very disturbing and very serious.
Are other cities bringing similar cases?
I think similar cases are being filed all over the country. I know for a fact, and all very much through the National Lawyers Guild, Los Angeles, I know, has filed at least one or two cases. In Chicago, I believe a case was brought on behalf of legal observers and the media who have been specifically targeted, as they have here in Detroit. The other cities, unfortunately, I can't recall offhand which other cities have been have brought similar lawsuits. I think Seattle, Portland. We are exploring the viability of other cases. Right now, first and foremost, our goal is to put a stop to the gratuitous violence and unconstitutional behavior of the police department. We are certainly seeking a permanent injunction, and we have what's called a Monell claim that is part of this case, which is a claim alleging that the unconstitutional behavior that's occurring is pursuant to the actual customs policies and practices of the department itself. And the extent to which the judge agrees with us that there are unconstitutional customs policies and practices within the department as a whole, we are hoping that through the evidence we present, she will hopefully enter an order that will put a stop to these widespread practices as a matter of course. In 2003, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the Department of Justice, the operation of the Detroit Police Department, the level of violence and the chaos that existed within the department was so rampant and so out of control that the Department of Justice, even under a Republican administration, saw fit to intervene and bring an action, a federal civil rights action, against the department for failing to keep track of its own officers and failing to take appropriate steps to make sure that their officers weren't just out there using excessive force on a daily basis. And that litigation went on for over 10 years. It was fraught with some scandal, unfortunately, and it took way longer to make the internal changes that the judge had ordered be made years earlier. but there were some significant changes that did occur within the department, but obviously not significant enough.
Yeah.
I believe this is not unique to Detroit, but our membership has increased significantly since the murder of George Floyd and the actions in the streets. And our, I mean, literally, we, until this period, any time that there was a need for legal observers, we had to beg, scratch, and crawl to get enough legal observers out to cover the political actions that were occurring, not even nearly as frequently as now. And now we've got hundreds of people on call and at least 9 or 10 legal observers at every single action, and it's just been phenomenal.
How can listeners learn more about this case?
Through our website, yes. We have a wonderful new staff person who has been keeping our website up to date on everything that's going on. We are participating in several coalitions, one of which the Detroit Legal Defense Coalition,
yes,
which came into existence consisting predominantly of Black-led attorneys and organizations, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the Detroit Justice Center, the Neighborhood Defender Service Organization, which is the newly opened public defender program here in Detroit, the Wayne County Criminal Defense Bar Association, have all joined forces, and they're all Black-led. And
great,
the National Lawyers Guild is participating in that coalition to help coordinate over 700 lawyers who have stepped up to volunteer to represent the people who are getting arrested out on the street. We also are part of a community-based coalition that is called the Coalition for Police Transparency and Accountability, of which the National Lawyers Guild is an active member, which is confronting this specific incident that occurred here on July 10th with what appears to be an actual execution by the police of a young man that occurred during the course of a drug arrest. And that coalition has 15 organizational members ranging from, again, the National Lawyers Guild, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the Detroit Justice Center, the ACLU, the Black Legacy Project, I can't remember the names of all the organizations, but it's a very exciting political development that is occurring here in Detroit, and I'm really thrilled. We are currently preparing for a full 3-day full evidentiary hearing scheduled for September. I think it's scheduled to begin on September 28th.
Right.
The judge has set aside 3 full days for an evidentiary hearing to determine whether she's going to convert the TRO into a preliminary injunction pending the workup of the case to go for a permanent injunction.
Thank you, Julie, for being on Law and Disorder.
It's so great to talk to you, and I want to give particular recognition to the young lawyers who have stepped up, who are really just totally dedicated to seeing this through and working their tails off to learn as much as they can about how to litigate a civil rights case, and they are taking amazing responsibility and leadership, and it's just really, again, it's just really thrilling. Thanks so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.